Earlier this month, a proposal to limit the height of new buildings in the heart of the plaza was rejected unanimously by the City Plan Commission as arbitrary and political. What inspired the proposal was a controversy over designs for a new building to house Nordstrom. The high-end department store plans to relocate to the plaza from Oak Park Mall in 2021. And the renderings they've submitted break dramatically with the old-school Seville-style architecture that's characterized the plaza for so long. It's been upsetting for preservationists and others who say the plaza is a neighborhood that gives Kansas City a sense of place. I feel that, but I also find it strange that part of our sense of place comes from essentially a carbon copy in miniature of an older city in Spain. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today we're talking about what the plaza and its architecture mean to us. I want to start with Bo Bledsoe. He's a flamenco guitarist here in town, and he spends a lot of time in Seville, Spain. The Seville in Spain. Hi, Bo.
Hi.
So we know that the plaza is modeled after Seville, but it's easy for those of us without that connection, I think, to kind of forget that. I'm guessing you don't forget that.
Well, certainly. I spend a large part of every year in Sevilla, and I also bring artists from there on my programs that I present. And I usually just don't tell them. I just kind of drive up on it just to see the reaction. And, it's always exciting, lots of selfies. And then I take them to LC's barbecue. That's kind of the route there. But I think it's important to mention that not only is there a lot of architecture and imagery from Andalusia, from southern Spain, mostly from Sevilla, and a lot of imagery from Granada that's really not addressed.
Tell me more about that.
Well, it's like those little black lions around halls.
Mm-hmm.
Those are copied after the little lions in the Alhambra in Granada. There's a plaza there called Plaza de los Leones, and they're just copies from those. And there's a lot of tile imagery from the neighborhood of Triana, of scenes of the Alhambra. But more importantly and more interestingly for me, there's a town called La Puebla in central Mexico that has made most of those tiles. And if you really look through the back alleyways and then some of the office buildings, you'll see little scenes of towns that I know very well in Michoacán or the town of Cholula. But they're often by a dumpster or something. I mean, you kind of have to look for them. But they're really, really beautiful pieces. You just have to find them.
So it's interesting to me. I mean, you've talked about that you do this sort of like surprise drive-by on your way to LC's. But it sounds like your exploration of the plaza's aesthetic has not been a quick drive-by kind of exploration.
No, I mean, I used to live down there when I first moved to Kansas City, so often enjoyed looking at some of the scenes. But, there's tile work of a very famous library in Mexico City. And, a lot of the tiles are from Triana, which is the ceramic area of Sevilla where they make a lot of the tiles. It's also the fun gypsy barrio where all the good flamenco is. So, you get those two things at once. But, I would say more than half of the scenes that you're seeing are of little tiny towns in Michoacán.
So it is not just Seville. It's Seville that's being sort of outwardly acknowledged as a reference point, but that there are, it sounds like, a lot of reference points.
Yeah, the larger architectural pieces that you see, like the Giralda, that's a one-third scale it's essentially a minaret that has a Renaissance capital on the top, the real one, and the little fountain in front with the little heads, that's a dead ringer for the real one. I mean, it's very, very close.
This is so okay. Do you enjoy the aesthetic connection between the cities of Kansas City and Seville and then with all these other places as well? Or do you think of it as kind of imitation Epcot kind of weird?
Sometimes. I mean, some of the execution on the plaza isn't as good as some of the earlier versions, especially in the ceramic and tile work. when you get to the handmade pieces, and then you see the sort of obviously the factory made tiles. As you get really more west into the plaza, you'll start to kind of see that. But it's really a phenomenon all over the city. You see echoes of these Spanish style architecture or Andalusian style buildings all over the city. I mean, it's just kind of concentrated there. But I've always wondered why that is. I mean, you have buildings along the Paseo and things like that that are of a similar design.
You know, when you mentioned before that people from Seville who you bring in for music performances, yeah, that they get out and take selfies in the
Oh, it's highly amusing. Yeah, yeah.
Amusing is how you would categorize how they feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, they're not off-put. You know, it's just kind of a big surprise. They didn't see it coming. And but you have to realize the real Giralda, you know, is an immense architectural feat. It's 35 floors that are ramps that a horse goes up to ring the bells. And it's, I mean, if you ever get to see it in person, it's a really different experience than the one here. And it's attached
to scale and otherwise.
Yeah. And it's attached to the largest Gothic structure in the world, in the third largest church in the world. It's an immense place where Christopher Columbus is interned there. And but, you know, ours is attached to the Cheesecake Factory, you know.
Yeah. I mean, here's the deal. I personally feel two ways at once that don't seem like they could live in the same person's brain,
sure,
at the same time. I grew up here. I spent a lot of time on the plaza. It is part of the cityscape that gives me a super Kansas City kind of feeling. And I am attached to it and I fear change. There,
sure.
I said it. But I also want to see this place fresh and vibrant. I want it to be unique, not just within Kansas City. I mean, I have the idea that good architecture is original. I have that idea. And maybe that's also a pretty naive idea. I don't know. But the idea that the plaza would lose its uniqueness if we allow it to change sits a little funny with me, because wouldn't it be more Kansas City and less Spain if we did allow it to adapt to our changing needs?
Hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? I mean, I know you're not the architecture person, but we're going to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of, I mean, to me, the eastern part of the plaza really speaks to me. As you know, as you get further west, it gets a little chintzy and kind of silly. And so, yeah, build your new thing over there. I could care less.
Let's talk to a historian. He is a professor of American history, specializing in cities in particular at Columbia University in New York. He's written lots of books, including The Crabgrass Frontier, all about suburbanization in the United States. And that classic urban studies text has a whole chapter on the plaza, which he charmingly calls the Country Club District. Kenneth T. Jackson, good morning.
Good morning.
So locals have their own perspectives on the plaza, why it matters, why it looks the way it does. But as an unsentimental outsider, why do you think the plaza matters enough to warrant a whole chapter in the story of suburbanization?
Well, I think there are several things about the plaza that are important. One is it's early. In fact, I would call it the first real shopping center in the United States. I mean, other places claim it, but I think the idea of the planned regional shopping center really originates in Kansas City. I mean, there's Roland Park in Baltimore and a few other candidates. So one thing is it's early. Second is it does have this, it's all architecturally similar. So whether it's borrowed from Sevilla or somewhere else, to the outsider, you know, it has a kind of unity that seems much more interesting than the typical American shopping center.
So there's cohesion.
Yeah, it does have a cohesion. It seems like a place. It is a place, and it's a pretty big place. It's also big, by the way, in terms of space. It's one of the larger American shopping areas. And it's also, what would I say, up? It's sort of tony. In other words, it's the whole neighborhood, as well as the shopping district, speak of affluence. And, you know, you don't defend that all the time, but this is, to me, Kansas City's signature. I mean, it's a city that's, that one thing about it is it's got the lowest population density, in other words, the number of people per square mile. It sprawls more, essentially, than any other American city, including Phoenix and Oklahoma City and places like that. It's really, the density of the whole area is really around 1,000 per square mile.
And the plaza and that has something to do with that to you?
Well, I think the plaza is so spread out that it sort of loses cohesion. The Country Club District has cohesion. It's kind of an alternate downtown. It's unlike almost any other American shopping area. I think the Galleria in Houston is sort of like that. It's, the Galleria is big and prosperous, but the Galleria does not, to the quick looker, does not seem to have the visual integrity of Country Club.
So this is interesting to me. What you call the Country Club District and what we call the Plaza is, as an alternate downtown, you know, when right now downtown is pretty happening, but during a period when it was not.
But not so much with shopping, is it? I mean,
it is now. But, you know, what's interesting.
Is there a department store downtown now?
No, right? I don't believe so. Department store, no. But, you know, what's interesting. But what I was going to say is that during sort of the lower lows of activity points for downtown proper in Kansas City, I did hear that idea floated that we should stop calling that downtown, that our real downtown, that our real city. I did hear that theory is the Plaza, is the Country Club District. Why would you think that would happen?
Well, because the Country Club District is unusual. You might even go so far as to say unique in the United States. It's not, by the way, it's not just a shopping area. They're also, as I call it, the Country Club District. They're also houses. They're pretty nice houses, too, if I remember. But the integrity of the area, the quality of the area, the early development of the area, the mixed use of the area. So it's not just stores. You know, you've got offices of dentists and lawyers and other kinds of people there, which often usually on the second floors, but which also give it what people are looking for now when they're creating a vibrant new downtown. Often they're trying to bring people into it to live there, but also to, you know, to have second and third floors. So activity will be going on, not just with shopping, but in other ways. And the Plaza has tried to do that. For now, it's almost, well, it's really almost 100 years. I mean, 90 years, whatever. 85 years, I guess it is. So it's really quite remarkable and I think quite nice. I really do.
You know, so full disclosure, I took one of your classes at Columbia. It was a class on the history of New York City, and the class was framed in many ways by a larger question about why the story of New York unfolded very differently from other American cities. And something you said in that class has stuck with me. I've actually quoted you on it a lot, so I hope you don't correct me. But you said, history is for losers. And I'd like you to explain that because I think it might be relevant to this discussion about change on the Plaza.
Well, what I meant was that, you know, the preservation movement or the people who celebrate the past, any building in the past is not, to me, worth saving just because it's old. And I think New York's strength, aside from it's incredible, so it would be the flip of Kansas City. New York will have the highest density in the United States by a long shot. So there are more people and more things in a small area in New York. And there's intense fighting in New York also about every new building and every new change. But I think a city has to change some. So Kansas City is changing. And it's okay for a smaller area like the Country Club District or the Plaza to remain the same. But Kansas City itself has to change with the times. You can preserve smaller areas of the region as the Country Club District is and the Plaza without killing the area. But what I worry, I mean, New York has 30,000 landmarked buildings. I think that's a few too many, and it will stifle the growth. And so it's a separate issue. But what I mean by, I obviously do not personally believe history is for losers.
You are a history professor.
I spent my whole life doing history. But what I really mean by that is that people cling to history because they can't win in the planning fights. So then they say, well, let's just keep it because it's old. Well, I don't think that's a good enough reason. And I wouldn't advocate that just for the country club district either. But I think it's one of the best merchant and also residential areas in the United States and has been now for the better part of a century. And I think it's kind of the signature part of Kansas. When I think of Kansas City, I don't think of the stadium. I mean, I think a little bit of the World War I Museum and a couple of other things that appeal to me. But I think of, I can't think of Kansas City without thinking of the shopping area.
What
Jesse Clark Nichols did. I think he's an important figure in Kansas City history. He really is. He left his mark.
Well, yeah.
You can tell where
That's
he was.
That's true. Let's hang on to that thought. I want to bring in Nicholas Bach. He's an architect and Kansas City native, I believe, with us from Gould Evans Goodman. And what's your take as an architect first, and then we'll get as a sentimental Kansas Cityan second?
Well,
should those be different?
They sometimes are not the same thing. An interesting thing about the plaza's history is the style that we talked about earlier, the Sevilla style, is when it was built and manifested, the Spanish colonial revival style was very popular in the United States after the Panama-California Exposition in 1915. But that style eventually waned in 1931. But the plaza was built generally in that scheme at the time. But over time, it's evolved. I mean, when it was first founded, I guess you could say, it was on the very southern edge of the city's limits. And all of that land was annexed a couple of years after J.C. Nichols started acquiring land for the plaza. It was a neighborhood shopping center initially with bowling alleys, grocery stores, and kind of evolved into something else by the 1970s with different style buildings. And it continues to evolve. And I think
it's kind of something else. Although, you know, like the plaza that I grew up with had a drugstore and it had a lot more of the activity was oriented toward the neighborhood.
Precisely. I remember in high school in the early 90s going to Seville Square, I think it was, to see movies. And now that's a Cinemark, amongst other things. And it will probably evolve again. At the time, there were probably like four department stores, and now there's really kind of half of one and soon to be another one. I think that is reflected in the style, the architectural style as well. And I agree with Beau that there's a certain intact area that feels like an appropriate scale. And it's also resonates to me as a Kansas Cityan, but it also, to me, is a very small part of the overall Kansas City story, even though it is iconic. For us, it's not really
Do you feel in any way attached to the plaza?
As a Kansas Cityan,
yes,
I do.
As an architect, though, no?
As an architect and as somebody interested in the built environment and sort of the history of places, I'm usually more interested in the way the place was used, not the style of the building that's extant, that's there now, or was there.
Well, so I want to turn to Hesse McGraw. Hesse is also with us from an architecture firm, El Dorado. He hails not from Kansas City, but from Nebraska. And he got into architecture from a very, very artsy, designy kind of background. And Hesse, do you remember your first impressions of the plaza as someone without that personal sentimentality, I guess you could call it?
Sure. So, Gina, I actually grew up in Olathe.
What?
I'm
sorry.
It's all right. I was indoctrinated at a young age.
I'm mistaken. But what are your early memories of the plaza? And what are your thoughts about it? Listening to all these different perspectives.
So it was a family tradition, I think, as with most people who grew up in Kansas City, you were, as a kid, dragged to the plaza. And one of the interesting things about it is there was never a surprise. It was exactly the same every time you went, which, you know, maybe if my parents hear this, they might take issue with me saying this, but for me, that lack of surprise feels fundamentally unurban. It feels like a kind of theme park. And I think for folks that are inclined to think that Disney World is perhaps the most authentically American place in the United States, they might also think that the Plaza is the most authentically Kansas Cityan place. So for me, the question of how it evolves and, you know, maybe if we dig a little deeper, what its roots are, what its actual roots are in terms of J.C. Nichols' planning philosophy, it's worth considering.
Wait, what are you getting at there? I think I'm picking up on something, but I'd like to hear you say it.
Yeah, so, you know, J.C. Nichols was obviously has left an enormous legacy in Kansas City, positive and negative. And he developed the Plaza in the early 20s, also developed Mission Hills and Sunset Hills, parts of Prairie Village, parts of Brookside. And his core philosophy was permanence, was aspiring to a kind of permanent status for those neighborhoods. One of the ways that he did that was through racist covenants that were attached to the individual plats, the deeds of each property.
Well, okay, so there's that too. Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about the Plaza, its architecture, modeled after a city in Spain yet so distinctly Kansas City at the same time. Do you welcome change on the Plaza? Do you fear it? Some combination of the two? Do you feel attached to it? Or do you have these criticisms? 816-235-2888. Call now. We'll be right back. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we've got a full house this morning talking about the Plaza, in particular the architecture that defines it, but more broadly, why we fear change when it comes to this Seville-inspired aesthetic. My guests are urban historian Kenneth T. Jackson, flamenco guitarist Beau Bledsoe, and two architecture nerds, Nicholas Bach and Hesse McGraw. Hi again, everyone.
Hello.
You can call 816-235-2888 to join this discussion. I want to go ahead and take a caller who's been waiting a little while now, Johnny in Kansas City. Hi, Johnny.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good, how about you?
Good. I just wanted to comment that I think it's so sad that, to me, having grown up around here and grown up running around the Plaza as a little kid in the 60s, the essence of the Plaza is and what made it uniquely Kansas City is totally gone now. I mean, it was a place where local people could actually do business and with local businesses, and those have all been purged in favor of nationally recognizable brands in order to make the Plaza a destination for tourists rather than anything that, you know, local people can really relate to.
Well, Johnny,
I mean, Bruce Watkins was there.
You mean Bruce Smith,
I think. Cafeteria. I mean, Tivol is still down there. But that's about the only thing that's uniquely Kansas City about the Plaza anymore.
Well, hang on, Johnny. Let's get some feedback on this. I mean, it does seem actually like that was the trend for a while. Now there does also seem to be a little bit more of a mix than there has been for many years, though Nordstrom clearly is not part of that. Nordstrom is a nationally recognized brand, although people flock to Oak Park Mall from all over Kansas City to go to Nordstrom. So I don't know that it's just tourists, but I'd like your input on that. Is the Plaza a tourist destination, or is it for Kansas City? Nick, what do you take that?
It absolutely is both. For locals, I live somewhat near the Plaza, further east, but I find myself at least using the movie theater. There are maybe fewer local businesses, but at the time, maybe the 1960s and before, Kansas City was a much smaller, less spread out place. So there were fewer opportunities for those kind of environments. And a lot of the people and businesses that may have been in a place like the Plaza then have since moved further and kind of continue the sort of transient evolution of Kansas City as a place where you build and then kind of leave behind,
except for
the Plaza, I guess, which as a tourist place became more of a you build and then you continue to reimagine over time.
When I think about what's on the Plaza now, it is interesting that this is changing somewhat, but a lot of the shopping destinations, not so much with the food, but like you would see the exact same set of stores at Town Center Plaza. And it used to be that the places on the Plaza, that was the only place you could go to those places.
That exclusivity, which obviously has a lot of meanings when it comes to the Plaza and J.C. Nichols, it seems less a major part of its identity today.
Hesse, you know, you get back to that exclusivity. Can you flesh that out just a little bit more? Because that seems to be an important part of your take on this.
Sure. I think the point that it's for both, it's for locals and tourists, is correct. And even in the case of the restaurants, you have the Cheesecake Factory across the street from Rye, which is a great locally owned restaurant. So you have those two things sharing space. You know, In some ways, I think the Plaza is a great urban neighborhood. It's one of the longest standing master plan developed urban places in the world. And yet, perhaps similarly to what Beto O'Rourke said last night, you know, El Paso is the safest large city in the country, not because of the fence that's there, but in spite of that. I think the Plaza is a great urban place, not because of Nichols' sort of racist ideologies, but in spite of them. So the thing that I'm excited about in Kansas City now is the renewed focus around equity by other developers that are doing work surrounding the Plaza in close-in neighborhoods.
When I think about the architectural piece that we started with, I mean, Nordstrom, which is the most recent building design to kind of raise these conversations again, you know, it would be hardly the first building to break with the overall architectural style. It wouldn't even be the most dramatic, in my opinion. I mean, the Steeple of Light Church does not look Spanish. It is very distinctly mid-century American. It was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, adapted, you could say, by a local sculptor, Dale Eldred, who gave it the light component, beaming up to the heavens. That is very uniquely Kansas City. It is not derived from any other city, including Seville. Do things like that enhance the Plaza aesthetic in your mind or detract from it?
Such a great example, Gina. I mean, I think it's that specific work by Dale Eldred is something that transcends the Plaza, and it's something that we can look towards as a kind of common ground. I think similarly, James Woodfill's work on the top of the Soul Grave, which is kind of the animated horizontal band of light on the Soul Grave, is something that transcends the neighborhood. Even the bridge, which El Dorado had an opportunity to work on right outside of the station here, the Troost Bridge, which is
with glass,
which is a translucent glass bridge, is something that, you know, ideally, and the goal is that it brings people together around something other than shopping, let's say.
Absolutely. And I mean, you can see I'm glad you brought up the Frank Lloyd Wright church, because just adjacent to it, currently there was a 1970s office building that appears to be renovated into apartments. And it seems to be trying to harken back to some style that isn't really contemporary, nor
imitation
sort of thing. And it seems like the safe route for a lot of people is to try to, I guess, align with that perceived style. But the reality is a lot of times people don't fully understand what that style is. So you get this pastiche of things, and that might be what Bo was talking about on the west side of the Plaza as well. Mm-hmm. I think with things like the church and the bridges and even the top of the Soul Grave, or the Soul Grave itself, there's a better quality of different eras and periods of time that relate to the overall infrastructure, which is much more like a city and less like a planned exclusive Epcot like you could call it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the copies that they're trying to that they have maybe put in the 70s they're just not very good in quality.
The quality of replica matters to you?
Most definitely for me. I mean, some of those replicas on the eastern part are kind of amazing. You know, they have those big lost wax bronze lanterns and the crosses with the thorns around them. And they're amazing. I don't think that's going to happen if someone tries to build another building there. Well, mostly you can see it really in the ceramic tiles for me.
And the fact that it's pretty matters. I mean, I guess you can't call prettiness a fact, but I find it pretty.
There's a beautiful book that the Kansas City photographer Mike Sinclair has made.
Oh, yeah.
That includes images of exactly these details that mm-hmm. you're talking about, Bo. And it's, I think over many years, he's documented the handmade tiles and the porticos and the entries and some of the things that you might glance over if you weren't looking.
Yeah, they're very much easily ignored. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, a lot of them, you have to go by the stinky dumpster to view them.
So you might propose the change of moving the stinky dumpsters.
Yeah, or maybe, you know, what Sinclair's done or some kind of tour or just for people to be aware of what a lot of these images are and where they're from.
Matt in Baldwin City wants to talk about this exact issue. Matt, good morning.
Well, hi. Hey, I've been listening to the discussion. I think it's a real good and interesting one. When I go to the plaza, and I'm through Kansas City a lot, the thing that strikes me is the level and density of hand craftsmanship of things. Like the balcony building is a good example. You know, the little detail of the balcony makes a big difference. The idea of handcraft really encapsulates a certain amount of human time and effort and skill. And it would seems that this is a great way to connect architecture to the experience of being human, is to include a lot of craft, like stained glass windows and ironwork and plaster work. And for instance, I've been in Unity on the plaza a whole lot and up into the rafters a bit, and you can see how the entire structure was built essentially in mesh wire and then hand plastered. And I think that really transmits a lot of human experience, human time, and human quality.
It sounds like you like being there and being part of that.
It means you like being there. You feel good in those surroundings. Now, it's also true that Unity is designed around a whole lot of, you know, intense number magic, like the Fibonacci numbers and stuff. But it's I would think that if Nordstrom wants to build a building, they ought to step up, contribute to the community on the level of providing to the community that level and density of fine craftsmanship.
Well, thanks, Matt. Thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to also talk to Teresa in Lenexa. Hi, Teresa.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so glad you're having the show. I'm so glad you're having this program. Years ago, I, having been in the retail advertising and broadcast business industries, I used to have friends, primarily East Coast, West Coast, broadcast friends in particular, who would come into Kansas City for the first time and thinking, you know, Kansas City was just a big old cow town, nothing to be excited about. And I would insist on picking them up at the airport and driving them into Kansas City, and with, of course, the primary destination being the plaza. And they would be astonished. And their opinion of Kansas City changed instantly, and they were just, like I said, they were astonished. And Kansas City, the plaza was iconic and beautiful and charming. And I love architecture. I love the horizons that architecture faces and embraces. But they're all parts of this city that new architect can be built. And no other city has a country club plaza. When I think of going to Europe, for instance, certainly I'm happy to see wonderful new architecture, but that's not the primary drive or motive for me going to Europe. I want to see the charm and the culture that's there. Not that we're talking about the same kind of thing in Kansas City, but Kansas City does have something unique and charming and astonishing to people from places other than Kansas City that sets it apart.
Thank you, Teresa. Thank you for that call. You know, I want to bring back Kenneth T. Jackson. Kenneth, you have been listening in on this very local conversation as someone who studied the Plaza from outside of Kansas City and placed it in the context of its national significance. What do you hear in this very local conversation?
Well, I think I would be a little bit easier on J.C. Nichols because of his racial restrictive covenants. We live in a racist nation. Certainly the 20th century was such. That was true even of Levittown in the late early 50s. In other words, and we still live in a kind of racially segregated society. So I think including that, it's something we're sorry about. We're sorry about many things in the past, and we can't change them. But I think it's like saying Abraham Lincoln was a racist. Well, he was, but he was much more liberal on the subject than just about anybody else around at the time. So I don't think we can take them out of their time and place. And I think the quality and importance of Plaza and the Country Club District stands despite the evidence racially restricted covenants that were there.
And that is perhaps another show, but so that's the main thing that you hear about?
Well, I mean, I think people do recognize that there is something unusual or unique about Kansas City, and it is this area of the city, maybe 10 square miles, that was largely planned by J.C. Nichols and has been pretty carefully taken care of since then relative to other places. Yes, there have been changes in the plaza. But relative to the other changes in Kansas City, downtown, edges of town, anywhere else, it's probably changed a little bit less.
Yeah, you know, and Nicholas Bach, this brings us back to kind of your earlier point.
It is interesting. I mean, there's a lot that may be worth preserving, and it's not just the plaza. Like, there was an upcry over the balcony building 5 or 6 years ago. I can't remember exactly when. And at the exact same time, an old church, I think it was Holy Name at 23rd and Benton, was being slowly dismantled. And that church had in its own iconic history that was important to its own community, and beautiful 110-year-old building that...
And this maybe points to where we can do better now.
Maybe pay attention to all the whole city.
Well, Bo Bledsoe, Hesse McGraw, Nicholas Bach, thank you all. Thank you to historian Kenneth T. Jackson with us from Columbia University. It has been so great getting everyone's perspectives.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
Tweet us your family's pictures of the plaza. We're at KCURCST. I will dig one up of myself trying to pretend I am eating a burger with that burger statue, the one that's now by a bank. Anyway, tweet us at KCURCST. We'll be right back with something entirely different. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And a few months back, we did a short profile of a local bar and restaurant owner who won a prestigious fellowship from the James Beard Foundation. Caitlin Corcoran of Sava in Westport was one of 20 fellows nationwide to participate in the James Beard Foundation's Women's Entrepreneurial Leadership Program. Her focus was what industry insiders call front of the house. That's the social part of the restaurant experience, the hospitality piece of it, the reason you can either love being in a local hangout or hate it, not necessarily having a whole lot to do with the food. Well, Caitlin has some fairly radical ideas about hospitality, and people are listening. She just wrote a manifesto of sorts, and it was published on the James Beard blog. Caitlin Corcoran, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
So the refrain for so long has been the customer is always right. That's not the model that you are writing about.
Correct. I mean, not that we're trying to bully the customer, but some customers and guests don't treat the employees and the workers of restaurants very nicely. And so we just want to make sure that workers have rights as well, and that people can feel safe in their work environment, free from harassment and any other sort of thing like that.
Your own experience as someone who's worked in the restaurant industry is a big part of what inspired you to think differently about this. So you work in this industry because you love it, and we are going to get to some of the not-so-great stuff in a minute, but I want you to start with what it is you fell in love with.
So I've been in the hospitality industry for 19 years now. I started when I was in high school, but honestly, I've been around restaurants my whole life as my mom was a pastry chef when I was growing up, so I really grew up around that culture. I've always just loved having people over, hosting parties, creating the vibe, choosing music, starting conversations between people that don't know each other. So that's what I love about the hospitality industry, is just making connections and letting people have the best day of their life or commiserate the worst day of their life in my establishment.
So at this point, I'm going to issue, I guess, a trigger warning, because Caitlin's story involves sexual assault, or actually rape. But Caitlin, can you tell the story that you told in your article about something that made you feel unsafe in a job at a restaurant?
Of course. So this happened about 7-8 years ago, but I was working as a bar prep person, and I was doing prep in this restaurant that had kind of an open kitchen. And I looked up over the stove and I saw the man who raped me years before, and he had recently gotten out of prison, which he went to prison because I sent him there. And I did not know that he had been released yet, because I had just moved and I did not get that letter that they send you. So it was quite triggering. I looked up and immediately it felt like a bag of bricks had just hit my chest. And I ran to the dry storage area of the restaurant and was having a pretty intense panic attack. And the chef owner of the time was in the office working on spreadsheets, like you do as an owner, and didn't really pay me much mind and just told me to kind of like calm down, like take a deep breath, and then like just get back to work, you know, sort of thing. And that was, I still worked for that place for another quite a while longer. And every day I worried that I was going to have to experience that again, because the guest wasn't talked to. The guest, like, my safety wasn't the concern. My support as the employee wasn't the concern. They just didn't want to make a scene. But also, like, legally, like, I had, like, pressed charges and I had done the stuff that you're supposed to do as a rape victim and as a sexual assault victim. And I still wasn't protected at my place of work from that person after they had been released. So it's like, yes, like, the guest is right and you shouldn't like make a scene, but also like your employees should feel supported and safe and not worried that they're going to run into the person that raped them for years and years and years every day, you know.
So fast forward, you're the boss of a place and you get to decide how to handle stuff like that. How did your thinking kind of transform into a different model, not of, it's of hospitality that extends toward employees, but it's also an idea toward what customers deserve that might include someone feeling very much like you did in that moment?
So the biggest privilege is that I do have this place of power now, and I've worked really hard to kind of hone what my hospitality vision is. Also, a lot of playing into that is that I was a gender studies and sexuality studies major in college. And so I went to St. Teresa's. These are topics that I've been working on and developing for myself for most of my life. You know, I was a baby feminist early on. But I do think that hospitality inherently, because so many restaurants and so many people directing that for years are white men and they have a different perspective, I do think that I was just trying to take into account everything and all the work that women of color, people of color, trans people have been doing for years and years and years, and they just haven't had the platform to be able to really start making that huge culture shift. And so I'm a white woman. I'm educated. I have a lot of privilege in that. And now that I own a business, I'm like, oh, wait, I can create whatever kind of culture I want. And don't want to be that boss that is unsupportive. I don't want my workers and employees to feel that they're just like a cog in the machine and that I'm taking advantage of them. I mean, capitalism is also like part of patriarchy. And so some of this is trying to be like a better, more socially minded, equity focused employer.
So, okay, I want you to talk about how this is playing out in your bar, because I can imagine some listeners thinking, how are you going to pay the bills if you do not sort of like let customers behave how they're going to behave, come in, buy things, and pay you for them? I'm curious how this has played out in your customer interactions and in your customer base.
So Savah will be 5 at the end of February. So we've been around for a while now, which is really awesome. Honestly, a big thing is that we are a small place. We only hold 40 people. So I don't need everyone to love me. I don't need every frat bro that wants to do a Jaeger bomb shot and hit on chicks to come in and do that. Like, that's not the vibe I'm creating, and very purposefully so. That being said, you know, we have signs that we support MOXA. We have Black Lives Matter stickers. We have a bunch of different kind of like value proposition posters around our establishment that kind of talk about what our ethos is without even people having to hear this conversation that we're having right now. That being said, I do think over time, a lot of the kind of attitude towards coming into a bar and how people usually act in places, especially in an entertainment district, are not what's happening at Savav, because we've had these conversations and because people know that, hey, if you come in and you're wasted and you're going to stumble into a group of people that you don't know and try to like aggressively hit on them, that's not okay here, you know? And we had way more incidents of that in the past, but the past couple of years, you know, most of the time the guests act right, you know, and the people are coming and supporting us because of our values and because of our ethos. And there is a lot of restaurant competition out there in the world. And, you know, I think that this is a big thing that differentiates us. And I also like think that most people are understanding that they do need to like support with their dollars and don't support corporations that are doing horrible things and treating their employees badly, but also like support small businesses that you are aligning with, support immigrant-owned businesses, support women businesses, support people of color businesses, go to the dodgy part of town and eat at a taco place. Like, I think that people have that mindset. But that being said, you know, we've definitely like offended some people, but those people also usually tested the boundaries and were not in the right. And so I don't necessarily want them to come back.
So, okay, you write in this article on the James Beard blog about your first time confronting a customer and kind of like setting what you decided were going to be your establishment's boundaries, no matter what's sort of like generally seen as acceptable bar behavior. Can you tell that story?
Of course. So this was now, I think, like 4 years ago at this point. But it was a busy Saturday night. And these two men that seem to be presenting as men were getting kind of like in their cups a little bit. And one of them went to the bathroom. And when they came back, they sat down at a table of really attractive people that presented as women. And the women instantly recoiled. And, you know, we got them out of that situation and they kind of like snuck out the back. They paid their tab. They got rid of this guy. But then as the guy like drank a little bit more, he did this to another table on his way out. And so this was the second time he had like kind of interjected himself into another person's experience that they didn't know. And their body language showed me that they weren't comfortable with that. And I was actually training a new host that night. And I kind of was like, hey, hold on, I need to go like look at the situation. And I went over and I just kind of bluntly was like, do you all want to give him your number? Like, are you interested in that? Do you want to go get a drink with him? Do you want him to buy you a drink here? And they instantly were like, emphatically, like, no, please get him to leave our table. And so I was like, hey, sir, it seems like you're already on the way out. Your friend's waiting for you at the door. Like, looks like you've had a lot of fun tonight. Like, I can call you a cab if you want, but you need to leave. And he was like, what the F? Like, and got super aggressive towards me about it. And I have learned that a lot of men, especially in that mindset, you can treat like kindergartners. So I told him, I was like, I'm going to count to five. And when I get to zero, I'm going to call Westport Security. And I got to three, you know, like, and he immediately left because I just started going five, four, three, like literally talking to him like he was a toddler. And he like left. And the host that I was training, who was actually still a really great regular, was like, whoa, like, that's awesome. Like, we can do that. And I'm like, well, yeah, like, I don't like going to a place that I feel like a piece of meat or that I'm going to get hit on at every interaction with someone. Like, this is not the kind of bar that I want this to be. Both tables that he had done that to were having a really nice time before he interjected himself, and they were not looking to pick someone up. You know, it wasn't that.
You know, what has been the reaction to this idea of hospitality being out there, not just for all of Kansas City to read, but for the entire restaurant industry to read nationwide?
I mean, I think that was the really awesome thing about the fellowship is I had been doing some of these trainings and equity stuff with my staff, and I thought that Coasts were doing it, bigger markets were doing it. And the thing I learned on this fellowship was they're really not. But I do think that because we have MOXA in Kansas City and because we have a lot of great conversations starting around race equity with the mayor's office, I do think that people here are prime to start this sort of thing. And it's really great that like people you know, think of us as a flyover, but we're really doing some progressive stuff in Kansas City on, you know, considering like everything that's happening nationally.
Caitlin Corcoran, this is interesting stuff. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and ideas.
You're welcome. Thanks, Gina.
Caitlin owns Sava in Westport, and she was a James Beard Fellow in 2018 attending their Women in Entrepreneurial Leadership program. Her manifesto on safety and hospitality was an outgrowth of that fellowship, and it can be found on the James Beard Foundation's website. We will link to it with audio from today's show. KCUR.org/Central Standard is where you'll find all of that. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.